My name is Warren Zola, and I'm the Executive Director of the Boston College Chief Executives Club. Welcome to our podcast of the September 27th Forum, featuring Dr. Albert Bourla, Chairman and CEO of Pfizer. As one of the top CEO speaking forums in the world, the Boston College Chief Executives Club gathers Boston's top business leaders several times each year. For this event, Karen Lynch, President and CEO of CVS Health, engaged in a fireside chat with Dr. Albert Bourla, Chairman and CEO of Pfizer. The conversation focused on Pfizer's role in the scientific renaissance coming over the next decade as a result of rapid advances in technology and biology, combined with the growing health needs of an aging population, the future of drug discovery and government's role in pricing, and the need for leaders to remain optimistic.
So excited to have you here. I know everyone's excited to hear from you. As you probably know, Albert and I got to be good friends during COVID when he was making vaccines and we were distributing them. So we owe a debt of gratitude.
And together we saved a lot of lives.
We did. So we owe a debt of gratitude to you for the rapid win. So I thought it would be important to start off to learn a little bit more about you, and we'll do some rapid fire questions. So maybe share with us what your best piece of leadership advice has ever been.
The best piece of leadership advice. I would say that aim high, because you will be surprised how much your people can achieve if you do that. There is a quote that always, I memorized it from my high school. It's Aristotle that said it and stuck it into my mind. That's 2,300 years ago, who said, our problem is not that we are setting the bar high and we miss. Our problem is that we set the bar low and we hit. Because that brings the essence of what mediocrity can do to leadership, right? So you have the illusion that you're successful when in reality you're not. So I would say that one.
Well, I think it's great advice. Why don't you share with everyone what your first job was?
My first job was in Pfizer in Greece. I was in academia, but my first commercial role was Pfizer in Greece 30 years ago to this year. I was recruited to be the scientific director of the animal health group.
That's awesome. Yeah. So tell us, given your heritage, what's your favorite Greek food?
Lamb.
Lamb. All right. So what is one word that you would use to describe Pfizer's long-term vision?
It's the ambition. I think that's what likely separates right now Pfizer. We are setting very ambitious goals. And many people have debated if this is something that set you for success or for failure, but this is who we are right now, ambition.
And what's your favorite way to recharge?
Nothing exciting, Netflix.
Netflix, all right, so you're a binge watcher. So you were at
I wish I could say reading German philology, but no.
Well, or poetry. We'll talk about reading later because you have a great book we want to talk about. You were at the UN General Assembly meeting last week. And as you know, they're gathered world leaders to talk about climate change and sustainability. What were your takeaways from that meeting?
Look, I think what everybody sees, that the world is confused a little bit because there are a lot of things that are happening right now. And the world is kind of scared of the unknown. We are in transitioning period. The war in Ukraine is always top of mind, and what that means, that's saying the relation with China, the climate, and the heat of the year, AI, was in the forefront of all the discussions with all of them. From my perspective and your perspective, what I've noticed is that health remains top mind for most of the political leaders, despite the fact that right now they are clearly absorbed into more acute issues that are happening right now. And the reason why, it is because the demographics are pointing only to one direction. The society is getting older. People are living longer. As a result, issues, health issues that were not important before or didn't even exist, now they are becoming important issues. So the need for medical innovation to be able to address those issues before they become a financial and social burden to the societies is really top of mind for them. I wish that they were also long-term thinkers so that they can think that maybe they can start investing, but they don't. They are scared about the economic situation, and all budgets, public budgets, all governmental budgets are in huge debt, so they are all pulling back.
Thank you for sharing that. I know that your personal and company values are at the heart of every single decision that you make. And earlier this year, you talked about Pfizer's purpose blueprint, including your ambition, and that's a consistent theme for you and your leadership, to change a billion lives by 2027. How does your purpose factor into your overall ambition? And how do you remain kind of rooted in that overall purpose and the values while you're accelerating the goals that you're trying to accomplish?
It is hard, it requires discipline, but it is extremely important for success. I'm sure all business schools can confirm statistics like the ones that I'm going to mention, but companies that they are staying true to their purpose. Not every company will have a purpose statement. We are doing this or that, right? But companies that they're staying true to their purpose perform way better than those that they don't. Let's say Google's purpose, right? We are organizing information on the world and we make it available to all. Or CVS purpose, we help people find...
We bring our heart to every moment of your health.
To find their heart. Thank you, that's it. So it's extremely why I think when everything that you do stays true to this purpose, because it gives a guidance to the thousands of people as to what is the compass, where we are going. If Google starts doing other things, people are confused. If everything they do are connected with this purpose, they know that our goal is to organize the world's information and put it there. CVS, if your purpose is we want to help people find their path to health, and you're saying cigarettes, right?
Right.
Employees will be confused. What is our purpose, health or something else? You stopped selling cigarettes 5 years ago. I remember that. It was even more.
Longer, yeah.
Even longer, yeah. So what a brave decision, because the profitability of those pharmacies at the time was highly impacted with the selling of tobacco. But that sends a signal to the people, this is why we care, this is what we want to do. So I think that's the main reason why every company, when they stay true to their purpose, it's the compass that they go together.
So Albert, maybe share some of the signals that you've been sending to your company to support your purpose.
Very good question. Every CEO here in this room has every quarter earnings. So we are releasing an earnings statement. And that's what Pfizer does for the last 75 years that we're in the stock market. The CEO usually sends a note to the people of the organization, and they say, today you announced our earnings release, our sales were that much, up 5%, our profits were that much, 30%, our cost of goods went that, all of that, but we are summarizing the earnings release. I thought hard about it, and I changed that. So this message now says, good morning, everyone. Today you announced our financial earnings statement. If you want to find details, press here. Now let me tell you what really we accomplished this quarter. We treated with our medicines 1,250,000 cancer patients. That's 5% up from last year. We protected with our vaccines 300 million babies. That's up 5% versus last year. You immediately give a sense to the people of what matters in this company. Now, whom do I try to fool? Do you mean that financials, they don't matter? Absolutely. Because everything we do, we don't do it with our own money. We do it with other people's money. To use Aristotle's Onassis' very famous expression, OPM, other people's money, they're called shareholders. They can give the money to us or to you or to someone else, right? So you need to be profitable. But if your aim, if your whole strategy is how to make bottom line higher rather than how can I treat way more patients and have impact in their lives, the money will not come. If you achieve the first, you can rest assured that financially you are going to be one of the most successful enterprises in the world. And that's the difference of those that they will go well and the companies that will excel. And they will do the unthinkable, and those are the ones that they will jump into the top league.
Such great advice. You know, you recently announced a partnership with Flagship Pioneering, a competitor in some regards, to talk about the new pipeline of medicines. And how do you see this, what we call kind of co-opetition, evolving in your world?
I think it is a must. I don't think the old model that things were happening into the big labs of the big pharmas or the big labs of the Ivy League schools or big colleges is not sustainable anymore, and I will explain why. It is because we have a tremendous proliferation of knowledge. Right now, for every medical need, there are tremendous amount of biological targets that are known to us. That they are, if you do something about them, you can affect the medical need, right? And for every biological target, we have so many modalities that you can go after them. In the past, things were different. We knew that heart attacks is the main unmet medical need. And the world knew that cholesterol is the big thing about it. So we should do something about cholesterol. And there were two or three ways to go after it, and statins, Lipitor, if for all, was one of them. So it made sense that you try inside your four walls to bring the best scientists that they know cholesterol and statins and develop the best medicine. It was going to be one bet in a roulette that has maybe 36 slots. And because you place five or six bets, you have a good chance to win. Now, with the proliferation of knowledge, where shall we start? The roulette has 36,000 slots with the knowledge that we know. So it's impossible for anyone, doesn't make sense to have singular bets. What you need to do it is to enable an ecosystem that is comprised from thousands of biotechs, only in this country, 5,000. In China, even more right now. In China, they are exponentially increasing the number of biotechs that exist. To enable an ecosystem that you bring what you know to do better, which is you know to do clinical developments better, you know to do manufacturing better, you can bring products to the market, and then you try to partner with many of them to see when some of the early science goes to the next level. And then this is where you can place your bet and make a role. So that's what we did with Flagship. Flagship has, it's an organization under which they have 20, 30 right now different companies that they have, each one of them one technology. Yeah. Moderna was one of their companies. Now it's public, but before it was part of Flagship company. It was the mRNA company, right? Now Flagship has this organized a lot of companies based on this technology. So with them you can say, look, I want to address the obesity problem. Can we do now a brainstorming and then find that eight of your companies will try to find the solution and bring to us? And of course, we put a team and they put a team, right? And then we try to see eight different ways of doing of going after one disease. So that's the essence of that, the collaboration. It's your ability to spread your risk and your bets will give the results.
I think it's a great blueprint for all of us to think about how to partner and build for the greater good. I want to take a step back for a minute because as you think about the vaccine development during COVID, you know, your company acted with a high degree of urgency and an incredible commitment to innovation. How are you keeping sort of the company focused and instilling those values as you kind of come out of that and evolve into the next generation of products?
First of all, I'm not sure if I do it very successfully. Slowly, we are slowing down. And I can see that. And it is not me, and I'm getting agitated. And then people remind me, you cannot operate always in war. You need to learn to operate also in periods of peace, right? And I hear them, but still I want to go faster. It was easy to do it during the COVID period. The world was not in normality. There was fear, there was darkness. People were questioning if the civilization, the way we know it, will remain after a year. You remember all of that, right? So it was, we couldn't visit our grandparents, people were dying. So to be able to rally a team under a purpose, let's save the world, that was very easy, right? So all you have to do is to demonstrate to them that you really mean it, that it's not a joke. That's why we didn't take the money from the government, we put all in, we did things in, we never did things sequential. That's why we're very fast. Instead of, I try first this, and if it works, then I take it to the next level and then the next level. It is the normal and cheap way, cost-effective way. I try everything in parallel, and whatever fails, I don't care. It is a very expensive and fastest way. So this is what we did. When they saw that, then they gave all their self. There were people that will stay sleepless 7 days. And then they take a day to sleep, and that's it, right? So a lot of that. And they're not talking about 10 or 30. Maybe 30 were the key people, but they were the minds, the brains behind it, okay? I'm talking about thousands of people that they had to do something, right? Either in the manufacturing or in the execution of the trials. Thousands of people that they had to run the studies, etc. Now that, now, and also the reward was amazing. Tremendous, because those people felt so proud for what they are eventually able to achieve, but you can't change it with any monetary or any other type of reward. They really felt proud. They would go in 21 early when the vaccine was there to supermarket, and if they were wearing a Pfizer logo, sir, the groceries on the store, right? So they unbelievable, let's say, love that and gratitude that we received. But then, of course, things came to normality. And now, when I have these obnoxious things, give me a timeline, and then, okay, we'll make it in 11 months. And then I say, what about 11 days? They don't look at me the way that they were looking at me during COVID. They think now that I have psychological issues. But we need to do it. The first thing that, because I knew that this would come, I told everyone, guys, look, we have achieved something that no one of us thought we would achieve, and we saved the world and all of that. Now, but if we were able to do it with COVID, why we cannot do it with breast cancer? You tell me why not. And you tell me that it is less important, right? Because if you move fast in cancer, you know what is the difference? The difference is a father or a mother to live long enough to see the graduation of the daughter or the wedding of the son. You think that that's trivial? I think that it's not important, right? So still, when you're working in an industry, people really can resonate and do the extra mile. And this is what we're trying to do now, but it's less easy than in periods of war.
But it's still rooted in your purpose. Speaking of speed, urgency, and innovation, on everybody's mind is artificial intelligence and the rapid advancement. You know, we're in a generational change of technology. What's Pfizer doing to harness all of the AI benefits to support your company going forward?
Yeah, first of all, I have very little doubt that this is one of the most transformational technologies. We can discuss whatever we want. I think that would change fundamentally the way that we do a lot of things. And it's controversial, and will be backs and forths, and will be regulations that they will try to control it or to slow it down, and there will be voices that they will say that's absolutely what we must do, and there will be other voices that will say no, we should focus on the positives that are coming on that. But the water on the river never goes back. The Pandora box is open, AI will be transformational, and as a result will prevail. And I think it's the task of all of us to make sure that we use it to the benefit of humanity and to the benefit of our purpose, of what we do. Particularly in our case, as with all cases, I think we'll affect every single step of what we do. You should think of a pharmaceutical company like a group that masters four capabilities. The first is the discovery. So we have a group that discovers things that didn't exist before. The second is the clinical development. So a group that takes those things and proves to regulators and doctors and to the world by running clinical trials that they're safe and effective. The third is manufacturing. Takes those things that were proven safe and effective and manufactures them in a very specific way. And then we have the commercial. explains to the doctors why they should write it, to the patients why they should take it, and life goes on. All four of them will be disrupted in the way that they operate with artificial intelligence. In discovery, for example, instead of doing drug discovery, which just, what does it mean? Means I'm looking for a pool of potential candidates to discover which one works. Which means I'm having 3 million maybe molecules that robots synthesizes, and I'm trying to discover which one of them will be the right one. That could take 4 years. From drug discovery, you can move to drug design. So in silico, we are thinking, how should look a molecule that will be able to hit this target, this biological target? And then the computer will design it. Yeah. And then it's not exactly the generative AI. It is a little bit of machine learning, but still artificial intelligence, right? And this is how we did Paxlovid. The pills for COVID were all designed in a computer. And instead of going into 3 million, we did 300 of them. And those 300 were tested in 4 months rather than 4 years. And so you see now the transformation that is happening. Now the same will happen. I can say, give you examples of how manufacturing can become more productive, how are with micro-targeting and AI that every individual will be receiving a different message in their marketing, let's say, approaches that we're having. Everything will be different.
Albert, one of the things that people worry about is security and response. You hear the concept of responsible AI. How are you addressing that in your company as you think about protecting some of the advances that you're making? And you know, how should we all be thinking about responsible AI?
I think they are right, everyone, to worry and think about it, because it's very powerful. And everything powerful, you know, in the hands of the wrong people, can do damage, but everything powerful in the hands of good people can do miracles, right? So that's why I say you can't stop it. When, nuclear, it was powerful and, you know, was used first for terrible causes, but then it has become one of the main things that the world is using. Computers was the same when they came. I can go on and on. TV. When I was a young kid, my mother wouldn't complain that I'm playing games on the internet. But she would complain, you're watching too much TV. You will be stupid, you don't go out to play. Everything that we say to our kids, it was for a TV before, right? I mean, the world keeps spinning, although TV was there, so nothing terrible happened. But clearly we need to regulate it. There's no doubt that we need to put some guardrails on it, but also we need to do it with an emphasis on let's prohibit falling in the wrong hands. So let's put some guardrails how that can be used. Let's prohibit that will not be abused. But also, the regulations should take into consideration, let's make sure that we are advancing, that we will be, let's say, as Americans, the nation that will master that, like the Chinese, that they will be very good in AI. Let's make sure how, in our hands, with AI, we will find the Alzheimer's treatment. Let's make sure that with AI, we will, all the things that the good things that we can do. So both needs to be taken into consideration, and we should not go one extreme versus the other.
So you wrote a book and you talked about make the impossible possible, and it's exactly what you've been able to accomplish. I don't know how you found time to write a book in the middle of everything, but maybe tell us a little bit about the book and sort of what brought you to write the book, but what are the key messages? And if you haven't read the book, it's a fabulous book called Moonshot. What are the key messages that you'd share with this group?
First, let me say why I wrote the book. And I wrote it because it became very clear to me that everything that happened during those days of 20 and then followed in 21 will become part of history. No doubt, as they became. But you know, history is written very differently from different people. So it depends on your point of view. If you are left, you see it this way, but if you are on the back, you see it very different way, right? So I wanted to make sure that I leave behind a testament of how things happen from my perspective. Because it was clear, but and that came before the big politicization, et cetera, and all this anti-vaxxer, et cetera, but how things happened. And that was very important for me. That's why the whole book explains this is what happened, this is how I was thinking, this is what were my dilemmas and what others did, et cetera. The second is I started feeling guilty because I started becoming very famous and because I was the face of the company. But clearly I knew who is doing the job, right? And there were a group of people that they were so pivotal in the development that their names will go unknown. So in the book, I name every one of them and I give a history of what they did, what they said, what was their contribution, how they felt as human beings. I mean, the head of R&D, Michael Dolstein, for example, as we were doing all of that, his wife got COVID and he was in intensive care and almost died. And because he had asthma and all of that. So Michael would try to visit her, which was not allowed. And he was using his connections to, I think she was in Mount Sinai, to the hospital so they can let him sneak in. And then he would come back to design the vaccine. Right, so what a story, right? I wanted to make sure that all of this will be said, so that's why I did it. Now, messages from the book is all over. One was the Aristoteles quote that, of course, I wrote there. But I would say one also leadership thing. It is that I learned in life that no one follows a pessimist. No one.
It's so true.
He can ground you, okay, a pessimist. He can make sure that you are not dreaming, but he will never be one that I say you say, go ahead, I'm coming behind you, right? Never. So part of leadership, you need to have the optimism. You need to demonstrate to the people that you're supposed to lead you that there is a way. I see light at the end of the tunnel. Of course we will make it. If not us, then who? I think that's a very important lesson that I got through that also.
You want to share your next moonshot with us?
Very clear, because you said multiple times, it is oncology, it is cancer, but where most of our investments are going. This is where I feel our science, together with money that we can bring in, science that we can bring in with buying money, could make a difference right now. For several reasons. One, it is, I think, our understanding about the cancer biology, why tumors are created, why a medicine responds and suddenly after a year stops responding and the tumor goes back, why you have metastasis, a lot of that are very well known to science right now. That gives you a significant, let's say, foundation that you can find solutions that can make a difference. And now we are investing in a new technology called ADC, that we are buying a company in Seattle. We are investing $43 billion to do this, to buy this company. The profits that we made from vaccines and Paxlovid on 21 and 22 and 23, and likely we will make a couple of years, we are giving it to the shareholders of another company, which are the shareholders of Seagen. Yes, we are buying few products with them, so that's exchange water with water, right? So it is. But the value of the products that we are betting is maybe 40% of the whole thing. The vast majority of the value, it is the promise of this technology really to make a substantial impact on cancer. So this is where we go. It's a very big bet. And that's where I spend most of my time now. And of course, we continue with everything else. But
we're all cheering you on that. So there's a lot going on in the healthcare industry, as you know. What makes you optimistic about the future of healthcare?
Two things. One, I spoke about it already, which is the need that society has for medical innovation is huge and is growing every day for the reasons that I said, the demographics, right? So there is a need to find something for Alzheimer's because now more and more people will have Alzheimer's. There is a need to find something for cancer because it's highly correlated with AIDS. As the AIDS living goes up, the number of cancers that will go up dramatically. So the need is there. On the other hand, the offer to this need also will be there. Science is so mature right now because we have tremendous advancements in biology, but also advancements in technology. So the AI of the world, the digital world, so those two, when they come together with biology and technology, will produce solutions that were impossible to find before. It's going to be what we call a scientific renaissance the next 10 years, right? So that makes me very optimistic when the demand for solution is there and the offer, I hope, will be very rich. That's what we do. So the healthy life sciences industry, I think, is going to be very optimistic. Not everything will be, though, tailwinds. We will have also headwinds. And the fundamental tailwind, it is that health usually is paid by government budgets. In many countries, the only, and in all countries, the major customer is governments of let's say, medicines, right? And they have to deal with the realities, as I said, of after COVID, the budgets are, the state, the government budgets are in terrible shape, and they are looking for easy solutions to manage it. And they are not necessarily thinking on the longer term. I mean, they know what is the long-term value. So I think that will be an issue. I think there will be a lot of pushback in funding innovation. And but still, overall, I'm very, very optimistic.
That's terrific.
Because so, nobody follows a pessimist.
Albert, I mentioned that I know people are interested in asking you questions, so I'm actually going to hand over to the audience to see what questions you may have for Albert. And I know this isn't a shy group. Thank you.
So neuroscience is considered one of the last frontiers in medicine. How does Pfizer think about the potential of the data, the science, and AI coming together to really innovate, whether it's in Alzheimer's or Huntington's disease or Parkinson's? Many years ago, Pfizer exited. But is the science getting back to the tipping point, and is it too juicy to not jump in?
Yeah, I think you are right, Pfizer. Pfizer exited, we made that decision, we had a lot of investments there, and we felt that the biological knowledge about the neurosciences, what happens in the brain, is not that advanced. I spoke about oncology, how advanced it is. We know a lot of things, right? We don't really know a lot of things for Alzheimer's right now. We have hypotheses of what creates it. One of these, the amyloid plaque, for example, we go after it, and we had some results, but with statistical significance, but not spectacular, right? So still a long way to go. And there are a lot of other theories, you know, it's not the plaque, it is the inflammation in the brain, and you know, it's not the inflammation, a lot of things. So over there, still the science was not mature when we exited, and now there's a lot of advancement because it's an area that a lot of money going over there, and a lot of scientific brain power goes into it. And I think we start now getting a little bit more, let's say, optimistic about understanding better what is going on. AI, I think, will advance significantly, will speed up the knowledge about the disease. And for Pfizer, we are clearly looking to see if we can find ways to enter. But in order to enter, we need to think that there is something that can make a difference, that can have an impact. So we are clearly screening all the area. I think neuroscience is the most underserved medical issue right now, both in psychiatry and in dementia and in all this, let's say, the forms of the Parkinson. This is where we have tremendous need to be able to develop solutions. It's very difficult not to crack. Many brilliant, trying for years, and still we haven't been there. So I hope the days that we will see someone being successful are close.
Hi, Albert. Brian Alexander from Foundation Medicine. I appreciate the focus on cancer. I loved how you talked about the urgency that everyone felt with COVID and the urgency that cancer patients feel about cancer, and like why should it be so different? And you also talked about how the pace of discovery is going to increase with AI and all these new kind of computational technologies. How do you see clinical development speeding up? You know, when you had a lot of cases in COVID, you could open and run trials. But with cancer, kind of as even in rare variants of cancer, is there any way that you at Pfizer are kind of thinking about how to take all these new hypotheses to tests and be able to test them in a more efficient way, especially when the sense of urgency isn't the same for people as it was for COVID?
Mm-hmm. Clinical development will be impacted dramatically also by AI. Just for everyone to understand what we mean clinical development, we have the COVID vaccine. Now we need to prove to the FDA that it's working. FDA has specific rules. This is what you need to do, so I'm convinced to give you a license. And usually this is a study that will include that many people. In COVID was 60 plus thousand people that will be blinded, all of that. So usually that takes a lot of time. And you know what is the time? The for every clinical study, there is the biology inside. So if you need to check something 6 months after the injection, that's 6 months. You cannot do anything about it, right? But in order to collect 60,000 people, if you start today, can take you 1.5 years. Before the 60,000 of person is there. So the recruitment of patients in the clinical studies always is considered one of the most important things that a company can do to speed up a trial, because that's lost time. If you can get all 60,000 in 1 month, then your study is done in 7 months. If it takes you 2 years, then your study is done in 2 years and 6 months. All right? So they're very important. AI can help you because you can find patients, and you can find spots where you can open your clinical centers, and you can do a lot of these things. Also, a lot of the patients, they are not going there because the studies requires a lot of visits to the site. Right now, we try to replace a lot of that with digital, either devices or so, and we were able in the last few years to reduce 50% on average the need for visit on the site. A lot of those visits are digital, are let's say virtual, right? On these checking points. If you have 60,000 people in a study, they all need to consent to tell you that I read what the study is and I agreed and I signed that I understand it, right? If you change something in the protocol, and when I say something in the protocol of the study, you agree with the FDA, say, you know, instead of using this thing, we should use in the third day, if we measure it, maybe measure it in the fifth, all right, something like that. Right? You need to reconsent or 60,000. The bureaucracy is huge. That could take months until you reach every one of them so that you can sign back. And you need to have physicians that, or let's say nurses that will call them to explain. AI with video and avatars can do all of them in 1 week because it's until they find, right? And they are in position, these avatars, to answer any question you have, to explain you why is the change, and to answer every question that they have. We pilot already in Pfizer, something like that. So, dramatic. I tell you, there is no area. And if I start to marketing, then we will lose our mind what you can do. There is no area that AI will not transform the way that we do business.
I think we have time for one more question.
Sciences and in the world. My question is pre-pandemic, we looked at a pandemic happening every 100 years, generally speaking. And now that we've encountered another pandemic and we're through that, what is your feeling about that on a going forward basis? Should we still be looking through that lens of every century? Secondly, is now that we have had a pandemic in the modern age, the 2000s, our ability to respond to the pandemic, how would you comment up with that? And thirdly, lessons can we take away from the pandemic that we can sort of put in the shelf next time we have something like this serious?
I think the chances that a new pandemic will come are there. Now, is it going to be in another 100 years or in 30? Really, I don't know. But what plays a role it is the fact that what was in the beginning of the previous century, when we have, let's say, the Spanish flu, people were not traveling the way that they are traveling now. So if you have it in Spain, it was not that easy to go to China. Now it's gone the next day, right? Because so it's very, very difficult to control in the way that the world is organized right now. Now, lessons learned, I think there are a lot. Are those lessons will help us being better prepared? I'm questioning that. Let me explain why I say that. What I think was some of the key, a lot of things we learned, but some fundamental things, right? One, the power of science, and to be honest, in the hands of the private sector, right? That was what saved the world. The fact that the private sector can move with this speed, and the fact that science is so powerful right now, that if you give them the resources, can make miracles, that was a fundamental lesson that was there. Bam, right? Nobody will say, thank God we had WHO, and the world was saved, right? Or even CDC. But they will remember the J&J, the Moderna, the AstraZeneca, and also they will remember the companies that they broke the tests, and the companies that they brought. So it's a very important lesson. The second was that in order to achieve those things, there was a tremendous level of collaboration between state and public and private sector, not only in academia on the public, that was tremendous, but also in terms of regulators, the FDA. The FDA worked as hard as Pfizer scientists to be able to achieve that. We would spend a week that our team would stay up day and night, and they will, at the end of Tuesday night, they will press the button to send the findings to FDA, and they will go to bed. I knew the same night, FDA will stay 5 days sleepless to be able to turn around the data that we have received. That was tremendous, also the finding that we had. And I will go also into the health equity. Easier to say and declare it than to do it. When we started, I made the decision, which was also more costly decision, if we are successful, we need manufacturing. Let's start building manufacturing capacity now, like if we are successful, because you need to know that mRNA was never produced before in the world. There was not a single manufacturing plant anywhere in the world that was making any mRNA vaccine, right? We had to design the equipment that will produce mRNA and ask vendors to make it so that we can put it in our manufacturing sites and start manufacturing and producing it. So we made the decision that we will do two separate lines instead of one. One in the US and one in Europe. Because something told me, although it was not, my gut was telling me, if we are successful, will be almost like the Third World War, who will have it. So let's make sure that one is not blocking the other, so let's have two channels separate. And we made one, because this is where we had two very big manufacturing sites that they could do it. What happened was that the US and Europe, they start pushing restrictions. And you know, if you were US or if you were European Union, maybe you would do the same, right? If you were to make the decision, because I care about my American citizens or I care about the European citizens, but we couldn't send from US to Canada. It was not allowed, right? And I warned multiple times to the government that a lot of the ingredients that we are using to make the vaccines in the US are coming from other places. If they realize that this is happening, because they didn't even know that the chemical thing was used, you know, okay, and they will shut also the door over there, then what we'll have is vaccine for no one, not vaccine for Americans. That lasted 6 months, and then eventually was opened, right? The same was India. India was supposed to deliver all the vaccines in Africa. And then when Delta hit, which was the time that they were supposed to, they closed it even worse than US, until the end of the year, not until June, until December. So that's, let's say, another thing that, so for me, what are the lessons learned now? How? I think we should have the government creating an environment that innovation will thrive rather than hold back. The first decisions that the World Trade Organization had to make, let's make sure that the patents are not valid of these products going forward. Okay, so who will invest? because the patent is his intellectual property, right? And it was not by any means that the patents were in the way, but that's what they are thinking. The first thing that the conservative bureaucrats of FDA, not the guys who are very proud because of what they did, are thinking it is, we need to put more tougher, stricter rules, because they feel unbalanced that they bended their rules and they did things a little bit different, rather than feel proud. Again, I'm not optimistic that we are moving to the right direction. They should say, look what we did, guys. Go ahead now, Alzheimer's. If you bring me, I will do the same. Think they don't. And the same is WHO. Instead of trying to open the innovation, you know what they are discussing? That we will control the virus. If a virus appears in India, WHO now wants that. We will get the virus, and the sequence we will only give to people, like Pfizer, only if they sign the following conditions. I mean, they want the bureaucracy. So I think if those voices prevail, I think we'll not be well better prepared for the next. We'll be worse prepared.
Thank you, Albert.
We hope you enjoyed the podcast of the Boston College Chief Executives Club featuring Dr. Albert Bourla, Chairman and CEO of Pfizer. To learn more about the Boston College Chief Executives Club, a program of the Carroll School of Management at Boston College, please visit our website at www.bc.edu/CEO Club.